Right, y'all. Welcome to the Scott Horton Show. I am the director of the Libertarian Institute, editorial director of antiwar.com, author of the book Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan, and I've recorded more than 5,000 interviews going back to 2003, all of which are available at scotthorton.org. You can also sign up for the podcast feed. The full archive is also available at youtube.com/ScottHortonShow. All right, you guys on the line, I've got Sheldon Richmond. He is the executive editor at our Libertarian Institute, libertarianinstitute.org. He is the author of Coming to Palestine, which you ought to read so that you know about all that stuff that's in it. And also, he writes a column for us almost every Friday, many Fridays, called TGIF, The Goal is Freedom. And this one is called The Non-Intervention Principle. It's at the top of our brand new page at libertarianinstitute.org. Hope you like that. Welcome back. How you doing, Sheldon?
I'm doing fine. Thank you for having me back. Yeah, the website looks real good.
Cool. I'm glad you liked it, too.
Nice job.
Yeah, man. Okay. So, you know, I think I want to dial back the red in that maroon and make it a little browner maroon. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe it just depends which screen I'm looking at it on. Anyway. Great article. The non-intervention principle, where does it begin?
Well, the reason I picked that title is because I thought of this afterwards. It kind of echoes the more familiar phrase, the non-aggression principle that libertarians like to talk about, which simply says, you may not morally initiate force against other people. You can use force in defense of your life and innocent life, other innocent life, but that's it. You can't assault people, kill people, rape people, take their stuff, etc. So that was the title. What prompted the article was just stuff I've seen on social media, and I don't know if I've seen like full blown articles, but it's more in the nature of comments, which is why I didn't have any links to them because I really couldn't find them, but I sense there people don't fully understand at least the libertarian theory of non-interventionism in foreign policy and military policy. Maybe there are other takes that would use the term non-interventionism, but I'm talking about what I think of as the libertarian principle. And the criticism I see is people who accept intervention, at least under some circumstances, think that it's enough to simply say that the tyrant du jour, as I call particular rulers in my piece, if that person is bad enough, then that's all you need to show to make a case for U.S. intervention, regime change, nation building, whatever, war, just going to war, and they think that's enough, and so I think sometimes libertarians are tempted to take a shortcut to rebut that person by saying, well, the tyrant du jour, isn't really that bad or as bad as you say, because that seems to blunt the move toward intervention just by taking the rug out from under that person, right? Saying, well, the ruler's not that bad, so that kills your case for intervention. And I think that's a very bad move. First of all, I don't think it's a really honest move. It implies that if the ruler really were that bad, then you'd be fine with intervention, which is the libertarian, it seems to me, doesn't really want to say that, but why imply it? Another reason is, of course, it may not be honest. I mean, the ruler may be pretty bad, really bad. So what I wanted to do is reestablish the point that the libertarian case for non-interventionism doesn't depend on the moral stature of whoever happens to be the new target for government policy. There's nothing inconsistent about saying, yeah, that ruler is every bit as bad as you say. However, that's not enough. That doesn't make the case for non-intervention. Non-intervention stands on other grounds altogether, which I then go on to discuss. Now, another thing, and I can say what those grounds are in a moment, but right now let me continue with what I think are sort of fallacies. instead, you may say, like I said, you could say that the tyrant, this ruler in question, is just as bad as you say. So that's one case. Now, you might say, yes, I agree that the ruler is bad, but he's not bad in every respect. So in other words, you've overstated how bad he is. And you ought to be able to say that without being accused of being soft, you know, or on that ruler, or a puppet of that ruler, or a toady, or whatever, you know, whatever term you want to use. So for I give an example of Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria. I wouldn't want to live under Bashar al-Assad. He's done some very terrible things. However, there's something good you can say about him, namely that he's protected religious minorities, most glaringly Christians, and he's also a member of a minority in Syria. He's an Alawite, which is a branch of, you know, Shiism, part of Shiism, and that's a minority in Syria. And that, from everything I read, that is true. It doesn't get a lot of attention because the mainstream media and politicians don't like to, you know, say anything that goes against their narrative, that we have to intervene against him, or maybe, you know, overthrow him. But that's true. Now, if I point out it's true, those are not my grounds for non-intervention. And it also doesn't mean I'm pro-Assad, the fact that I can find something positive to say about him. So that's another point I wanted to make. And then the third point I make is I've heard libertarian non-interventionists be accused of the following. Oh, so you say it's wrong for governments, especially the U.S. government, to cross the border of another state and intervene. Obviously, if you're going to intervene, you've got to cross the border. I mean, especially if it's some sort of military, either your planes or ground troops or your missiles are going to cross the national boundary of whatever the state is we're talking about. And so I've heard libertarians accused of being nationalists, closet nationalists, because you have reverence for boundaries. You say the government should not cross another nation's borders. And I've heard this for actually a long time. And I wanted to put on the record that that's wrong, too. That's not the reason libertarians should oppose interventionism. It's certainly not the reason I oppose it. And the reason has nothing to do with any kind of sacredness of boundaries. I mean, we want to see boundaries reduced to, you know, nothing, or virtually nothing, because that's what open borders would do. So I have no reverence for national boundaries. My reason for non-interventionism is not that the nation state, you know, is somehow sacred, but, and this was a reason given by Albert J. Nock and then later on Murray Rothbard, we don't want states clashing and colliding, because when that happens, conflicts get larger, they get aggravated, and the potential for death and maiming of noncombatants gets greater. So as we have seen in the 21st century, if not, and we should have seen it before that, when the U.S. intervenes in a foreign quarrel, whether it's some kind of civil war or interstate conflict, if U.S. government piles on and intervenes, it's going to be worse. More people are going to get killed, more innocents especially are going to get killed, and all other bad things will follow from it. So it has nothing to do with respect for national boundaries. It has to do with keeping your own state, to use Knox's term, on a short leash, or as short a leash as possible. So those were basically the three points I wanted to make in this relatively brief article for me.
Well, now, along the last lines there, there's something about the nation beyond just the monopoly on force of any given state within its borders, where, you know, it seems that the American people, through our government, so to speak, owe a decent respect to their national independence. So I don't know if that means slavish devotion to the Treaty of Westphalia or something, but say, for example, in Venezuela, they want to have commie control over their oil resources. That's just not our business. For example, if somehow our government could change that without growing in power and without adverse consequences in a hypothetical, it's still, they have no right to tell these people somewhere else within their nation how their resources are to be divvied up. Or not? What?
Well, I don't think the state doesn't have rights no state has rights. So the U.S. government can't have the right to tell Venezuelans or the Venezuelan power elite, because I don't believe for a moment that the Venezuelan people govern Venezuela.
I bet they want a publicly owned oil company, as inefficient as I'm sure it is.
Right, but any decision is going to be made independent of that, even if that's true.
Well, that's probably so, right. Yeah.
So it ends up looking like I'm saying, yeah, if they want to nationalize, resources or otherwise, collectivize their economy, they, quote, have the right to do that. I just don't think the U.S. government has a right or anyone else has a right to interfere. Certainly any other government has a right to interfere. I just don't. Governments don't have rights, and it should not have the power for all kinds of reasons, sort of pragmatic as well as moral. Mm-hmm. The government should not have the power to do that because it won't only stick to the, you may come up with some, some libertarian could come up with some very narrow criteria for when it would be okay for the government, U.S. government, to intervene. And they may come up with very strict, that doesn't mean I'd buy their case, but at least I'd give them credit for trying to come up with some very strict circumstances. The problem is, in the real world, real world politicians and bureaucrats are not going to stick to your narrow set of criteria. There's going to be mission creep. They're going to, it's the public choice problem. They're going to work to expand their power. So even if you began with very strict criteria, those wouldn't last long. Those would be expanded very quickly. You know, there's a great piece of advice from the philosopher David Hume. He said you should devise policies as if knaves are going to be the ones implementing them. That's a very good rule of thumb that I would advise.
Yeah.
So you could come up with what sounds like a really good policy that's only going to have very narrow application. But what happens if it's in the hand of a knave?
Yeah.
You're giving power to someone who's not going to respect your criteria and will find a way to expand those or to justify and say, oh, no, I'm really satisfying them. Even though you, the author of the criteria, say, no, that doesn't satisfy them. You're not going to be the one making the decisions.
Yeah. One of my favorite Jefferson quotes, not that he respected this when it was his turn or anything, but he says, let us hear no more of confidence in men, but let them be bound by the chains of the Constitution, which, I know that you're a market anarchist, and so am I, but we do live in the USA, and we do, at least in theory, have this Constitution. And Article 4, Section 4, of course, says that the U.S., that is the national government, shall guarantee to every state in the Union a Republican form of government. And, the war power depends on how you interpret it. People interpret it pretty broadly to say that they have the right to launch aggressive wars. But this would certainly seem to indicate that their power to go changing regimes in order to make sure that they abide by the rule of law and so forth would end at the borders of the United States. That any state that ratifies this Constitution, whether back then or joining the Union later, that they are acceding to that contract, that they have to keep an independent judiciary, and I don't know if they have to have a bicameral legislature, but certainly a separate legislature from the executive branch and a Bill of Rights delineating, a set of ideas largely along the lines of those in the U.S. Bill of Rights and that kind of thing, or else the U.S. government reserves the right to change your regime in your state. But it seems like, I'm not exactly, it's the other Scott Horton that's the international lawyer and all this stuff, but it seems like the fact that they are expressly delegated that power when it comes to states in the Union would certainly imply that they lack that power when it comes to all the other 192 states in the world.
Well,
and I'm sorry it took me so long to figure out how to say that.
Case. I mean, I'm not a fan of the Constitution. I wrote a book about the Constitution, which I called America's Counter-Revolution. I wasn't the first to use that term in connection with the revolution. But even with my skepticism about the Constitution, I can see where it would be very hard to use the Constitution to make a case that it's within the powers of the national government to change regimes, to judge and change regimes of other countries. I don't know where Jefferson or Madison said, I can't lay my finger on the text, the provision in the Constitution that would permit that. That seems clearly outside of any kind of scope you could come up with from the U.S. Constitution. Jefferson also said in, I think, the Kentucky Resolution the proper attitude of a free people is not confidence in government, but jealousy toward that government. In other words, constantly eyeing it, that it wants what you have, namely your freedom, and it's going to grab it if it can. So, he said some good, definitely said some good things in those regards, even if he didn't always live up to them.
Hey, man, you guys are going to love No Dev, No Ops, No IT by Hussein Badakhshani. It's a fun and interesting read all about how to run your high-tech company like a good libertarian should. Forget all the junk. Read No Dev, No Ops, No IT by Hussein Badakhshani. Find it in the margin at scotthorton.org. Hey, y'all, here's the thing. Donate $100 to the Scott Horton Show, and you can get a QR code commodity disc as my gift to you. It's a 1 ounce silver disc with a QR code on the back. You take a picture of it with your phone and it gives you the instant spot price and lets you know what that ounce of silver is worth on the market in Federal Reserve notes in real time. It's the future of currency in the past too. CommodityDiscs.com or just go to scotthorton.org/donate. Hey guys, Scott Horton here for ExpandDesigns.com. Harley Abbott and his crew do an outstanding job designing, building, and maintaining my sites, and they'll do great work for you. You need a new website? Go to ExpandDesigns.com/Scott and save $500. I'm sure with you, and I think it's funny because a lot of the times, well, let's say virtually always, when our government is targeting a foreign country, they're lying about them. And there's always kernels of truth and plenty of reality to it. For example, Bashar al-Assad's government was in the middle of a war. But at the same time, hey, look at these three giant fake sarin attacks. One of them that was clearly a false flag. One of them that seems more like an improvised type of a false flag. And then another one that was clearly a false flag again. And, so here we got to debunk these most horrid accusations against the evil fascist dictator just because the truth is the truth. And also the lie lends toward the narrative of government intervention. And of course, Obama backed down in 2013, but in 2017 and 18, Trump fell for this twice and launched, thankfully, limited strikes against the Syrian government based on those lies. And so, as you say, our argument doesn't necessarily hinge on that, but it's also understandable why people think that, geez, Sheldon, all you do is defend dictators. It's like, yeah, but that's only because my government is falsely accusing them all day. They want to accuse somebody else, I'll defend them too. But you can see why people say, geez, you sure do take Noriega's side a lot. What's your beef anyway? Why would you? You know what I mean?
Well, we shouldn't be afraid of the facts. And, reality is complicated, and a given ruler can do some really bad things, terrible, terrible things, but that doesn't mean he's guilty of everything that someone can think up to say about him. And so if somebody does make a baseless accusation, and we have good evidence, we know there's no evidence that it's true, let's say, we shouldn't be afraid to point that out. And then we need to be ready to, first of all, look, we don't want to imply that if Assad actually did launch those chemical attacks, the ones that have been, undermined by the, people even involved in the UN's, Chemical Weapons Commission and other people, if he actually had launched those attacks, that wouldn't make intervention then, regime change in Syria, okay, according to a libertarian theory of non-intervention. That's what I want to say. It's an independent point, and we should. It's an empirical question. We can't know a priori that Assad launched those chemical attacks, the ones that you named. We can't know that. We need to look for the evidence and look to reliable, reputable people like what's his name, Ted Postal at MIT, is that his name?
Yeah.
Who's no axe to grind. He's a recognized expert in this, and we should take what he says seriously. It doesn't mean he can't make a mistake, and we should just take it on, that's it. That's all we need to know. No, we need to study it and decide and not be afraid to say, hey, he's right. Assad didn't do this without someone saying, oh, so you're soft on Assad. Or, Gabbard, Tulsi Gabbard's suffering this because as a member of Congress, she went to actually visit him. She also visited some of his opposition, and she's still dogged by the accusation that she's some kind of puppet of Assad. So, I'm not expecting consistent rationality on the other side. They'll continue to accuse us of being toadies because we oppose intervention. And no matter how many times I say, that's wrong, it doesn't follow, I don't believe I'll convince those people. So I'm talking to these sort of uncommitted people.
Sure.
Who let them be skeptical. They should be skeptical. When a non-interventionist says the bad guy didn't do all the bad things you're saying, the fence sitter should be skeptical enough to say, okay, that doesn't mean you're an apologist. I understand that. So let's see what the facts are. I'm just making a plea for rationality when it comes right down to it.
All right, but what's the limit? Because Hitler, and because, well, let's say, for example, what if Russia wanted to do to America the exact carbon copy thing of our Ukraine policy, and that would be overthrowing the government of Canada with a Nazi-backed coup d'etat and then going to war against all the people in British Columbia who refused to accept the results of the coup. Should America not intervene if all this is going on in Canada next door?
Well, I don't think we should intervene in Canada. No, I think we should. I think we're capable of having a home defense.
But the Russians, Sheldon, the Russians. I'm sorry. I'm trying to pretend to believe in it for devil's argument's sake. But yeah, no. So seriously, though, if Putin overthrew the government in Canada, installed a Nazi backed, say he got the right sector and the Azov battalion of Canada to come out to back the new regime, we should sit here and cluck our tongues, huh?
Well, I don't know if we should cluck our tongues. I don't necessarily endorse tongue clucking. But we shouldn't mobilize and invade Canada. We could annex Crimea. I guess we could do that. I'm just kidding about that.
Occupy Newfoundland.
Look, you can come up with nightmare scenarios. It's true from now until the end of time, and there may be some tough circumstances. But let's deal with the world as we face it. Putin is not going to do that, and I think there may be some resistance inside the Canada, even if he tried to do it. Mm-hmm. I'm not convinced he's trying to use Facebook to change the outcome of our elections. I don't think he's going to be staging a coup.
Someone just sent me a link. Trump is a Russian asset is trending on Twitter right now.
Well,
there was a briefing. Apparently, there was an intelligence briefing yesterday.
Headline about that.
Yeah, they in no way describe how they know this or why we should believe them, but they just say, yeah, trust us. Putin is working to reelect Trump.
And Trump, I guess, said something publicly about the NSA or whoever, whichever intelligence officials were doing the briefing. I guess he publicly criticized them. I saw some headline. I didn't see the story. Anyway, look, you can't base your day-to-day policy on nightmare scenarios or extreme emergencies. So, I don't think it's very helpful to come up with, Putin's about to take over Canada.
Yeah. All right. So what about, we saw in history, one of the worst kind of auto genocides, really probably the worst one ever, would have been in Mao Zedong's China, where they just reduced that place to the Stone Age, man. And just tens of millions of people starved to death, this kind of thing. And the U.S. government at that time, I guess, they had the Soviet Union to contend with, so it wasn't really even, you know, in question. But someone might argue that, hey, you know, we've had enough worst case scenarios in our recent history here, within living memory, that, you know, what if there really was something like that, where some commie regime is starving their own people to death by the tens of millions, and we frankly could change the regime if we would just bomb their capital city for a few weeks or whatever it is and put an end to something like that. It seems like, well, that is, it is worth arguing, because that's, of course, the nightmare scenarios are all they're ever going to come up with, and there are enough to choose from for hypothetical example type things, you know?
Yeah, but the problem with the exact case you've used is that you've walked in the middle of the movie. You walked into the theater, you know, after the movie started, because Mao is only in a position to do that because we intervened in Asia against Japan. Now, it doesn't mean I'm a fan of the Japanese Empire in the 1930s and 40s, but the U.S. intervened in Asia, which put Mao in the position, just like World War I put the, you know, the Bolsheviks in a position to take power in Russia. So you made a point there. You're giving an example that makes my earlier point, namely when the U.S. intervenes, chances are it's going to make things worse in ways you can't even imagine. I assume they didn't really think the communists would take over China if we moved against Japan and broke the Japanese empire.
Yeah.
But that's what happened. That seems, the lesson seems to be, don't intervene.
Sounds like it.
The point that Brian Kaplan makes, and when he makes his case, you can find this stuff on his blog at Econ. Is it Econlog? Yeah, Econlog. His case for what he calls pragmatic pacifism. So it's a, you know, you can be pretty close to certain that if the U.S. government intervenes in a foreign situation, it's going to make things worse.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I like how in the article you cite Albert J. Nock, the guy that wrote As We Go Marching.
No, that was John T. Flynn.
Oh, no, you're right. Yeah, that was Flynn.
Yeah. But Nock wrote
Nock was Our Enemy, the State, right?
Yeah. Which is a very, very good book, a very good look at American history, beginning at, you know, back at the with the Constitution, founding of the U.S. So, right. And he's the one who just made this common sense point that you need to keep, you know, quote, your state, the one you live under, because that's the one you have. You may not have a lot of access, but that's the one you have the most access to. Which may not be a lot, but you got to keep that on a short leash, because when states collide, bystanders suffer. There's a good shorthand way of putting it, right? When states collide, bystanders suffer. So let's at least keep our state, which is the most powerful in the world, of course, from colliding with other states, because good is highly unlikely to come from it.
Well, and we certainly know in this case, you know, I saw a thing where Noam Chomsky once said that the only actual, you know, legitimately humanitarian war that was ever launched that he knows of, or at least in recent time anyway, modern times, was when the communists of Vietnam invaded Cambodia to put an end to Pol Pot's reign of terror there and the refugee crisis it was generating. And then that was when Jimmy Carter and later Ronald Reagan took Pol Pot's side. Because they still hated the Vietnamese more.
I guess that means Carter and Reagan were good non-interventionists.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny because people say, that's not true. Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan backed Pol Pot? And then they Google it and then they go, oh, no, Ronald Reagan backed Pol Pot. And Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan.
I think there's a good case to be made that there wouldn't have been Pol Pot. Well, the person Pol Pot would have still existed, but he wouldn't have been what he became. Had it not been for the U.S. intervention in the, you know, into China, Southeast Asia, you know,
absolutely, yeah, in the name of preventing the dominoes from falling down, they were they blew up that domino and then created the absolute worst case scenario that you could have imagined as the result of it. And then that's the big irony, right? Is finally America lost and got out of the way of the Vietnamese regime, which went and put an end to that genocide finally.
Yeah, so there's lots of ironies there. It doesn't exactly make the case for non-intervention, does it?
Yeah. And Ron Paul, speaking of Vietnam, Ron Paul would always say, you know, we fought and fought, and there are people who would still have us fighting in Vietnam, and yet we're friends with them now and trade with them. Not that it's perfect, but it's certainly better, you know?
Of course. And, Chris, there are people who think we should stay in Afghanistan for 100 years.
You're right about that. There are.
Forever. Why? I can't, which seems like completely crazy to me, but there's not even a domino theory there. They don't even have the cover of a domino theory.
Yep. Nope. Just the magic portal to Boston Logan Airport that they don't even ever have to describe. They just imply exists. All right. Anyway, I'm sorry we're out of time, but great to talk to you as always, Sheldon. Thank you very much, sir.
Same here. Anytime, Scott.
All right, you guys. That's the great Sheldon Richman. He's at the Libertarian Institute, libertarianinstitute.org/Sheldon. And this one is TGIF, the non-intervention principle. And read the book, Coming to Palestine. The Scott Horton Show, Anti-War Radio, can be heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, APSradio.com, antiwar.com, scotthorton.org, and libertarianinstitute.org.